Hey, hey, welcome to the Chelsea Skidmore Show. Today's episode, I interview John Swab, who is a writer, director, producer from Tulsa. He made Body Brokers, which is a film I watched last week on Amazon, I think. And it was really great, and it was it really touched me. So I reached out to him via his producer at their production company, and I set up an interview because I wanted to talk to him and hear more about his life. And I like the stuff that he makes. I stalked him a little and kind of saw the projects he's working on, and he does a lot of, you know, cool fucked up shit, like the kind of stuff that I would love growing up that doesn't really exist anymore, type of stuff, like, you know, stuff that's like more grittier, and stuff that kind of reminds me of like Another Day in Paradise or Kids, you know, Larry Clark kind of stuff. And that fun stuff that you don't really see, you know. I mean, I guess I'm kind of saying that because this one had to do with drugs, but he's also doing another film that's about lot lizards, which is an interesting subject to me. And we get into all of that in this episode. And yeah, Body Brokers is about, you know, the scams that people run and insurance companies and rehabs and treatment centers and, you know, taking advantage of addicts who are trying to get sober. And this is just an important subject to me. So I wanted to, you know, advocate for it, bring light to it, and get this out there, what's going on, because it upsets me, you know, as someone who's sober, someone who is dipping my foot into working in recovery and realizing that I have a lot of integrity in this area. And I don't like the idea of people being taken advantage of when they're in a vulnerable state. And I had interviewed Ali Severino a couple episodes ago, who was in the documentary American Relapse and Dope Sick Nation. And that was the documentary version of what the film Body Brokers is. So if you're interested in this subject, check out all three of those to kind of just learn more about what's going on and how people are scamming insurance companies and taking advantage of addicts who are trying to get their lives together or not. And they're paying addicts as well to continue getting fucked up and work their way through the system, the recovery treatment sort of process, and scam some money. So pretty sick stuff. And yeah, so this is me talking to John. Enjoy the episode. And if you like what you see, please subscribe, rate, and review the Chelsea Skidmore Show. Thanks, guys. Have fun. Hey, what's up, John?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. You said you're in a hotel room. Is that the space room?
No, I don't know. It's actually really shitty artwork that you can't pull it off the wall. We've tried.
you have.
Yeah, it's some kind of theme they got going on here. We're in Montana right now.
Oh, I've always wanted to go there. I hear it's so beautiful.
It is. I had never been here. My producer, who you spoke to, Jeremy, neither of us had been here, but it's stunning. Yeah, it's really beautiful.
Are you working?
Yeah, we're prepping a movie. We're shooting and starting in 2 weeks.
Is that the Something Red?
No, Ida Red we shot already. We finished that. We actually just delivered it yesterday, or started delivering it yesterday. This is Candyland.
Oh my God. Wait. So I was stalking you, you know, at a prep on IMDb, and I saw the log line about Candyland, and I got really excited because I saw that Lot Lizard's dock. Is that what, are you allowed to talk about this?
I can talk a little bit about it. Yeah.
Okay. I got so excited for some reason. I just, first of all, I love like the worlds that you play in. And I get that this is going to be a little all over the place, but like, you know, like you just don't see cool movies that much anymore.
Yeah, I do.
Your vibe and everything that you do is like the stuff that I loved growing up watching, you know? that I feel like has been lost a little. So when I saw, you know, I saw Body Brokers and I thought that was really fun. And then when I started to look at the kind of stuff that you make and what your production company makes, I got really excited. Specifically the Lot Lizards, cause I watched that documentary and like, it was so interesting to me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I'm curious if that inspired you or if you like pulled up on a truck stop or what the story is behind it.
I'm from Oklahoma where, you know, one of our main exports is lot lizards. Lot lizards, meth, Bible, beef, guns. Yeah. Teen pregnancy, we do that well. In my time using before I got sober, you know, I had a lot of friends that made money in creative ways. Some of them were lot lizards. And I always thought they were just like, it was just such a great title, first of all, but also like such an interesting existence, I thought. I knew a few girls that were, you know, descendants of truck drivers and then became lot lizards. And I just thought that was fascinating. And, you know, I've never made a horror movie. I thought it, like the more I started kind of watching them, I didn't watch them a lot as a kid either because they never really scared me. But after making, Body Brokers and Run with the Hunted and Ida Red, there was something really liberating I found in horror because rules don't really apply. Mm-hmm. And when I was thinking about a concept for a horror movie, I always wanted to make a movie about lot lizards. So it just kind of seemed like the perfect marriage for a story, you know?
Yeah, that was interesting when I saw that. It is a horror movie because I'm like running my imagination. Like what could the horror version of that be?
Right.
I assume it's like the wrong truck someone gets into.
No, it's actually not. I didn't want to do the typical thing. So, I mean, really the way we've described it and how I conceived it was like an X-rated John Hughes movie. Pop culture references and like really try to make it fun with also really pushing the envelope with the horror and the other subject matter that's a little taboo, that you could imagine would take place in a movie about lot lizards. So I don't want to reveal too much about it, but it's going to be a lot of fun. It's honestly my favorite script I've ever written. And unanimously everybody's really excited about it who's involved. So
I'm so excited to see it.
Yeah, me too.
And are you using any real lizards?
We're in Montana. If I were in Oklahoma, I think, you know, we'd have a whole lot of, we'd have generations of lizards, roaming the set. But it's kind of uncharted territory up here. But it's all friends, you know, everybody who's in the movie is a friend of mine or Jeremy's, most of the crew we've worked with before or are friends of people we have. So I'm really excited to do this movie cause it's going to be kind of the most family. It's going to be like the most family vibe, familial vibe I've had on a set, I think. So it'll be a lot of fun.
That's cool. Do you typically then work with like the same crew that you've been? I mean, I know you've done like a bunch of films at this point. Are you, when you say like family vibe, is that because you built those relationships and you're using the same people or?
Yeah. I mean, this one, we're actually using some new folks on the crew. We have kept some and, are kind of trying out new people in other positions, but in terms of the cast, I mean, it's, you know, I wrote it ironically, almost everybody I wrote, the roles for is actually going to play it. And they're all, you know, friends of my wife's or mine or Jeremy's. So, in that regard, it's going to be, it'll be a pretty relaxed set, you know, where there's not a lot of egos and everybody's just kind of there to do the same thing and tell the best story possible. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I want to backtrack a little. I love that you're from Tulsa. I know a couple people from out there and I feel like so many creative people come from there. I've mm-hmm. never been there, but I have like this thing in my head about it just because it sounds really cool. And I know Larry Clark is from there and, right. Are Utah and Opal kind of inspired from Another Day in Paradise a little? Because they have those vibes to me. And yeah, I just watched that movie for the first time, so the reference is in my head.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
So maybe, but I didn't really think about that, you know. But Jeremy points it out a lot where he'll read a script and be like, or see the finished product and be like, that's directly from this movie. And I'm like, I didn't know that, but it definitely is. Subconsciously, it just, you know, mm-hmm. permeates. And you know, I think I love movies like that, that, you know, directly homage inspiration. I find my films, in my opinion, have matured and gotten better the more I embrace my influences and things that I, you know, instead of trying to hide from them or, you know, stray away from it. I think embracing it is really cool and leads to a more interesting story most of the time. So
yeah it totally, and it had like a little bit of like a Badlands vibe, but then it turned into something else. But I'd sure. say just the beginning, like I was like, oh, I love these characters because they remind me of like, you know, these like runaway 90s kind of
right
people.
Not to jump around, but
I'm jumping around so much, so just
we're taking
free.
that whole vibe from the front end of Body Brokers. And that's really all Candyland is going to be. Because I had so much fun doing that. And the way we shot, you know, the opening, I don't know, 17 minutes of Body Brokers was predominantly all handheld and felt just very like, I don't know. I love like early Gus Van Sant movies too. And it all feels kind of like that. Or at least that was the intent. So yeah, in terms of, I love that part of the movie too. And you know, I wanted to kind of live more in that space with this thing we're about to do. So
I love that. Okay. So yeah, again, I'm jumping around Tulsa. So what is it like there? Because yeah, if I feel like so many people I know out in LA who work in the business are from there. But then I also hear like other versions of people's lives, like, it seems like there's some people who were very like creative and other people who were just like doing the craziest shit. Like I hear such a mix of craziness. I'm curious about what it was like growing up for you there.
It was, you know, it's changed a lot since I was a kid. It's kind of always, you know, 10 years behind everything that's happening coastally, you know, or like, at least in New York or LA, you know, like I think kids were wearing JNCOs until I was like, you know, 18 years old, you know, and, you know, very slowly like style and fashion kind of, you know, made its way. But, you know, when I was growing up, and it still is extremely religious, and, you know, it was much more conservative and felt much more like a small town then it's kind of changing a lot now. I think there's been a lot of, you know, there's a few like pretty eccentric billionaires that live there and are from there, and they poured a lot of money into the town to kind of help build up the infrastructure and attract a lot of young people, and they've done a good job, but it's changed a lot. So, you know, you'd have to, maybe you'll tell me after this who you know in the film business from Tulsa. I only know Bill Hader and Gary Busey and Larry Clark. Like, I think that's kind of the only people. And I know Josh Fadem.
Josh was one of the people in mind.
Yeah. I don't know him, but I know he's from there and, went to school with, I think, my cousin or something, but yeah, it is a weird place that has, a really interesting history, and, a lot of people have passed through there, and, you know, I'm proud to be from there. You know, we've shot a lot of our movies there, and I've spent, you know, a lot of time there in the last 5 or 6 years. So this Montana thing's been really interesting to kind of break out and, you know, explore new territory. But, yeah, I love Tulsa. Obviously, the older I get, the more I think I appreciate it. I wanted to get out, you know, my whole childhood. I just wanted to leave. And it ended up becoming a pretty big cornerstone of my career in terms of, you know, really using the resources I had there to make these movies. So
yeah, because your first movie was made there, right?
With Manson? I mean, my first 4 movies. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So everything but this one. You know, Body Brokers was about 25% of it was in Los Angeles, but the rest of it was all in Tulsa.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Were the rehabs in, where were those?
That
was like a hotel room looking one, though.
Well, that was actually, I'm really proud of the job we did. And I was surprised with how, how well we pulled off cheating LA for or Tulsa for LA. Those were so the big auditorium was in kind of the grounds where Utah and Wood are outside, and he offers them the money. Those were in Los Angeles, in Calabasas, actually, at King Gillette Ranch. But everything else was in Oklahoma at you know, I think one or two homes we kind of, you know, pieced together to make look like a rehab.
Yeah, I started working in recovery as a sober companion in October for like
good money in that. I bet you're doing well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a good side job while, you know, I wait for other things. But yeah, and I was like, where the fuck is that rehab? I was like, there's no rehab that looks like a hotel. I liked what you did for the interior, but I know it's like painting the picture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I've been to quite a few rehabs, and I feel like they're getting more and more creative with the spaces they use for these places. You know, the last one I was in, they just rented a house and, you know, put a bunch of bunk beds in some rooms, and it was like a rehab all of a sudden, you know? So it looked pretty similar to the way we shot, you know, the rooms in a house we shot Body Brokers in. So, you know, but I've been in the institutional ones that are, you know, much more, you know, dodgy and lower end too. So yeah.
Like Yellowstone.
Is that, I don't know. I've been to probably 12. The worst,
really?
The worst I went to were in Florida. Those were really, really something. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sober too, but I never went to rehab. I always wanted to go, but my mom wouldn't pay for me to go. She's like, just fucking good at, you know, 12 step. And, so I'm always like, I'm jealous. So, okay. Are you cool talking about sobriety?
Sure.
Sorry. I'm jumping around again. I'm going to stop apologizing. Okay. So you went 12 times. Obviously something wasn't working. Like, what do you think that change was?
You know, more than anything, it was just me not being ready to really do it. And, you know, the first few times I went to rehab weren't to get sober. They were to get away from, you know, some serious trouble I got myself into. And I wanted to, you know, once I found out that rehabs, they couldn't reveal that you were there, even to law enforcement. So, or, you know, in my case, like other criminals. So I felt like, oh, that's a safe place for me to just go and stay, and nobody will know where I am. So that's kind of how it started me going to treatment.
That's smart.
Yeah, I thought so too. And it worked out.
Thank you, HIPAA.
Yeah, right, right. So I did that. And, you know, I did the same thing every time, where, you know, I'd put together like 60 or 90 days. I'd find another broken person, you know, preferably a female, that, you know, didn't want to be there either. And we'd leave and go do our thing, you know? And it was just a cycle I went through where I'd kind of get material things back. You know, I'd get some new clothes, I'd get a little bit of money, I'd get a girlfriend, I'd leave. And then, I did that same thing, I don't know, for, you know, quite a long time until.
Yeah. How many years were you?
I think it was close to like, must have been probably over like 6 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably over 6 years. Or right around 6 years. Yeah. And then the last time it just got really, really bad. And I finally, you know, did some things that I was really scared I was going to get in trouble for. And
yes, go on.
Well, no, just, you know, things that it was not, not good, you know, and there were serious, repercussions if I had gotten, you know, caught for doing them. So that happened. I got really scared. And then I also just ended up, I was living in an abandoned building in New Jersey and, you know, smoking crack and doing dope. And I was just tired. I was over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I kind of checked every thing off the list that I said I'd never do, you know, at that point, and then some, you know, I'd hurt a lot of my, like, you know, a few of the closest friends that had stuck by me, I'd hurt them, and I just felt terrible. So I called somebody and I got into treatment, and it wasn't, I didn't even really stay in treatment for very long. I was only there for about 10 days and then they kicked me out. But I, out of like spite, was like, I'm going to get sober to prove you wrong. And I met my, my wife is sober. I ended up just moving in with her, as we do. And never left, you know? So we, so yeah, but that's kind of like, you know, in a quick little nutshell, what happened. Yeah. But yeah, I went to, I utilized the program and, you know, 12-step program to, you know, and I met a lot of people there. And, you know, once I kind of embraced that those people don't want anything from me except for me to succeed, you know, my life changed, you know, so.
When you were staying in Florida, you were in some of the more shadier places. Right. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, you know, I remember I was living in New Jersey at the time, and, you know, I got into some trouble and I kept running out of money, and I, you know, I was just kept getting really, really dope sick and I was tired of it. And so one night I like Googled on my phone, like drug treatment, whatever. 'Cause I didn't have any money. I didn't have insurance. And, you know, they have such good like data tracking on those searches that they just start calling you. Even if you, you know, yeah, if you click on the wrong website, like they have your information. So anyway, I kept getting these calls, and I ended up kind of kicking dope on my own. I was about 4 or 5 days sober at that time. I was just without drugs. I wouldn't say that I was even sober, but this guy kept calling me from this treatment center in Florida and checking on me. He seemed really nice. And eventually I was like, I don't know how I'm going to, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. Even if I do get sober, I can't pay my rent. I don't have a job. I didn't know what to do. So I was like, fuck it, I'll just go to treatment. And so eventually, like after like 4 or 5 days of kicking dope, this guy called again. I was like, all right, man, I'll come. Like, just tell me what I need to do. And he was like, well, when was the last time you used? And I was like, 4 or 5 days ago. And he was like, okay, well, that's a problem, because you've got to show up and piss dirty. If you don't piss dirty, then like you can't be admitted. And I was like, okay, well, he was like, do you have any money? And I was like, no. And he was like, all right, well, I'm going to buy you a plane ticket and I'm going to Western Union you some money right now to go get a cab to the airport. And I was like, oh, okay, sounds great. And he was like, but you can't show up and piss clean. And I was like, okay, I don't know how I'm going to figure that out. And he was like, just go to the Western Union. So I show up at the Western Union and there's like $1,000 in the Western Union for me. And like, and the cab ride was only like $60. So I was like, what the fuck is this guy want me to do? So I went out.
He wants you to get so high.
Yeah. So I bought all sorts of stuff, and I had like, I called the cab and the cab just drove me around, like, you know, to all the spots, met all the people, got everything I needed. And I drove to the airport and just got so high. And then I got off the plane in Fort Lauderdale or West Palm, one of the two, and they had a driver there ready to take me. And he was like, do you have anything else? And I was like, is that a trick question? And he was like, no, it's not. I just need to know, 'cause like, we'll pull off somewhere. He's like, you need any beer or anything? And I was like, sure. Yeah. All right. So we pulled off, and like, I just sat in the car with this cab guy, or he was like more of like he was wearing a suit. And I just sat there and smoked crack and did the rest of my drugs and drank a 40 or whatever he bought me. And, because if you show up, you know, and piss for alcohol, you get even more drugs when you show up. And anybody who's been to rehab knows that, like, they'll give you, you know, other things. And this guy, you know, figured I knew that. So, yeah, I showed up there, and this place was like, I think most of the people were on like some kind of release from prison where they had worked it out, where they'd just go, you know, instead of finishing their sentence in prison, they would just go to this treatment center. So my roommate was a guy who had done 35 years for murder. and, you know, I showed up and they take me to my room, and it's like plastic sheets. And they have
plastic sheets.
Yeah, it was like the really, like the ones in case you shit your pants or okay. piss bed, like it's, you know,
like a detox sort of setup.
Yeah. So I showed up and they walked me into my room, and there's this big ass Samoan guy who walked me into my room, and I go into my room, and my roommate's like, he's probably, I don't know, I think he was in his 60s, and just ripped black dude, and he's just sitting on top of his sheets butt naked and like reading a book. And I was like, I don't know where I am right now. I was so high. I was like, this is hysterical. And I got in bed. I just sat my stuff down on my bed, and the Samoan guys, it was one of those places where, because of the violent criminals that were in there, but also because of the suicide rate at the institution, they had one-on-ones with you at all times. So I had to have somebody with me 24 hours a day within arm's reach. And so did my buddy and my roommate. So anyway, that was kind of my introduction to this place. And also, like, I have Crohn's disease. And so I couldn't eat their like boiled meat that they would serve. It like made me so ill. So they bought me a block of tofu that was about the size of a shoebox, and they said, just keep this in your room, whenever you're hungry, eat it.
Keep it in your room?
Yeah, so I had
was a there block. A fridge?
No, there was no fridge. So it was like,
what?
It was
crazy.
So it was, I mean, that's kind of the most extreme version of rehab I went to. Multiple suicides while I was there, and it was really eye-opening.
Wait. Like people killing other people or themselves?
Themselves, yeah.
Oh, did you walk in on anything?
One guy, I don't know if he succeeded in killing himself, but you know, they check out razors to you. You check mm-hmm. it out and you have to turn it back in. And he slashed himself with a razor, and they like, they call it bacon wrapping is the term. It's Baker Act, where you like take somebody and you take them to a psych ward and you put them in a straitjacket. But in the place, they called it bacon wrapped. So they bacon wrapped him and took him out. And there was, you know, blood everywhere. That was the last time I went to treatment and stayed. And then, you know, the time I got sober was after I got out of there and ended up going back to whatever I was doing. But you know, by the time I was ready to finally, you know, really give up, that memory of that place was not too far away. So, I think it helped. Going to all those different treatment centers really, really helped me kind of get to my place where I was finally over it, you know.
And I think it's important to point out that like the nice places aren't going to make you want to change or get better. Those are like fucking vacations for people. Like, you know, a friend of mine has been to rehab like 60 times, like so many times. And she just goes to like all the nice places like in Malibu and shit. And she literally refers to them as vacations. So I think like those low bottom ones are really what you really need to like get the fucking message sometimes, you know, when it's been a while. Like
Yeah. I had a girlfriend, that she paid cash. Her family paid cash for a place in Malibu, right on the beach, beautiful place. And because she paid cash, she could do whatever she wanted. I mean, mm-hmm. She'd walk around the house naked in front of all these people. And the owner was just like, you know, that's who she is, whatever, you know?
Who she is.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, God bless her, but it's a really interesting, experience going to all those places. I'm glad I haven't been back, you know, so.
But. Yeah. So the place you went to in Florida, is that place shut down now? Do you know?
I don't know. I got a call from them a few years ago to check and see how I was doing, but they do that, you know, for their client outreach or whatever it is, outreach, alumni outreach or something like that. But, yeah.
So was that your initial introduction into that world of body broker, junkie hunter?
Right around there was, I remember, I can't remember chronologically when, but it was either right before or after somebody called me and said, hey, there's a girl coming to tour our treatment center, and they knew that I knew her, and they knew that she had a lot of money, and or she came from a lot of money, and they said, if you can convince her to come to our place, you know, I'll pay you a check, I'll give you, you know, x amount of dollars cash. And you know, I was using, so that seemed like a great deal to me. So I called this girl and I said, hey, I heard you're going to tour this place. It's great. I know the people, and they are, you know, they're nice people. I mean, they really tried to help me. So I wasn't like lying. I just, you know, kind of tried to help sell her on it. She ended up going there. They gave me a check and I was like, oh, okay, this is cool. And then, you know, at the place that my girlfriend at the time was, the owner there told me, he said, hey, I know you know a lot of people. So if you can get anybody to come here, you know, you see how we take care of you, you know, you do whatever you want. If you can bring us anybody, I'll pay you. And so I brought like, I don't know, I brought like 10 or 12 people there and he paid me. And I was like, wow, this is great. And, I didn't think anything was wrong with it. And so I did that a few other times, but you know, once I got sober, I moved from LA, to upstate New York and really just tried to focus on, you know, my own recovery. And I got really far away from the whole treatment world and that whole existence. So it was kind of out of sight, out of mind. And, you know, a few years ago, I was visiting my wife. She was working on a film out in like, Slab City area. And I went and met up with some of my old friends from treatment and they told me, they were like, hey, you know, you should really look into this body brokering. Like you wouldn't believe what's happened. And I didn't really want to go back into that whole world. I had no interest in making a movie about drugs. I really did the best I could to remove that from my life. But I reluctantly like met up with a few people and they started telling me, you know, how much money they were making. And these were like brokers, like lower end brokers. And I was intrigued. And then they introduced me to their boss or the guy they worked for who they, you know, said was kind of the body broker. And
the body broker. Can you describe the body broker looks like?
Yeah, I can. So I met him at a West Side Hotel. It's not Shutters. It's the one right next door, the red brick one. And I met him in a Ocean View hotel room. He had a bunch of food laid out for me. And he had two guys that took my phone and, you know, like kind of patted me down and let me in to talk to him. And he looked like a white rapper, hip hop type guy, you know, like definitely, you know, had that vibe, that street vibe to him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I talked to him for like 4 or 5 hours and, you know, his story was really fascinating to me because it was a lot like, Utah's in a way where he came out to get sober. His intention was to come out and get clean. And, you know, he was kind of turned out by the treatment center itself. And so I identified with that too. And I really empathized with him because I saw what he came to do and I saw how, you know, easily somebody, if, you know, when you finally get the courage to ask for help, you're so vulnerable. And like, you know, when you're really trying to change your life and you're at zero and desperate, like it's really the luck of the draw what kind of people you come in contact with, because, you know, I've come in contact with the wrong people and I very quickly went back to doing the things I was doing. And even worse, you know, it took me multiple tries to, you know, give up, surrender, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, on this last time, luckily I was around people that actually cared about me and my well-being, and it really changed and altered my life completely. But this guy, the body broker that I was referring to, like he fell in with the wrong people. And they just replaced his drug habit with, you know, money and selling other addicts. And, he's really good at it. He said he made, you know, upwards of like 800 grand in a week at times.
What in California?
Yeah. In California, yeah, because he, you know, he was also involved in the implants. He was one of the big people involved with all that, and that's where a lot of money, you know, is.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah,
until I saw it in the movie, and then I was like, right. Oh, I guess that's going on too. I mean, there's so much that I'm naive to that I didn't even realize was going on, and it's so eye opening. And part of the reason why, like, I wanted to talk to you, and why also. Talk to Ali Severino, you know who she is. I'm assuming you watched those documentaries, American Relapse and
No, Dokes. Never seen them.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
It's about all of this stuff. And they're in Delray Beach in Florida, like, you know, finding people off the street and stuff and getting them in. And
right.
And I didn't realize, like, you know, it affects me so much because it's like after working in recovery for a little bit, like I don't like anyone being taken advantage of. Like, I think that's like, you know, probably like a deeper thing in me. Like, I always like have the fear of like getting got, you know, something obviously happened to me in childhood why I feel that way. But like, I just like, I want to bring this to light more because I think it's so fucked up. And, you know, obviously I can't like speak a lot on it, but like I've seen fucked up things that have really upset me, you know, witnessing in the recovery world, like treatment wise. And like, I don't know, I just find it like interesting and disturbing and fucked up. So like, you know, I think it's important to get it out there and talk about it more.
Agreed.
Yeah. And like exactly what you said, just like, you know, when people are in such a vulnerable place and abusing and taking advantage of them and bribing them with money, like it's very sick and disturbing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy though about the implants thing too. I didn't even know that. I like, there's so much going on in that whole world that like people don't even know, you know, and it's just like, I feel like I'm skimming above the surface and there's like a whole, like, you know, almost like a dark web world of all of that shit.
Yeah. It was hard when writing the movie, 'cause you know, there's yeah, like you said, and there's so many other layers to it, but you know, with the film being an hour and 50 some odd minutes, like you can't fit everything into it. So it was hard to fully explain everything. And also knowing when to kind of pull back and not go too deep, because, you know, you'll lose people if you start really bombarding them with too much information. And you know, the truth is stranger than fiction a lot of the time, especially in this case, you know? So, I mean, you know, when people kind of first started seeing the movie, they were like, so this is real? Like they didn't really believe that it was real. And we kind of had to reiterate that a few times with certain groups of people. But yeah, it's there's a lot to it. So
I thought you did a great job of explaining it. And I didn't even you just saying like it's almost 2 hours, like it flew by so fast. It, you know, like some movies you're like, oh, this is a 2 hour movie. Like your movie felt like an hour and a half.
Well, that's good. I mean, I, you know, the best part about the reception of the movie is that anybody like yourself who's familiar with this world, or, you know, has a connection to this world, you know, through a family member, has really validated its accuracy, you know, and, you know, didn't feel like it was long. You know, I find that people that don't have a connection to this, you know, it's so foreign to them that, you know, I'm not really sure how they've received it, but we didn't make this for them. So it's been nice to have people like you reach out and show your support.
Yeah. Fuck those people.
Yeah. Right.
Go watch a Pixar movie, you know, actually my therapist watched it too, 'cause I was talking to her about the documentary, but she watched the film.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So have fun. Yeah. Have people reached out to you a lot? I'm sure. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's been really cool. You know, like the character of May, who plays like the girl who works at the treatment center, who ends up kind of falling in love with Utah. The girl I based that off of loosely, you know, reached out to me like a few weeks ago and said the iPod. She just wrote the iPod because she gave me an iPod when I was in treatment center. And I used that little, you know, thing to kind of link them together. And like, so a lot of the people that knew or played a part in my recovery definitely reached out. But then, you know, I'm not on social media, but Jeremy's been getting, you know, like droves of, you know, people reaching out and telling us how much it meant to them, or thank you for finally exposing this story. This happened to me and nobody believed it. And, yeah, and then parents, you know, that this is, you know, they lost their children because of body brokering. So it's been overwhelming, the support we've gotten. With the film, it's far exceeded our expectations.
The ending was so sad. I just thought of that when you said the parents, because I imagined, you know, when he's sitting in the car.
Yeah.
Not to ruin.
Yeah, yeah. Sad.
Wait,
ending.
So that happened with May. Like, did you get to hook up with someone who worked at a
No, I didn't. I embellished that part a little bit for the story, but she became a very good friend of mine, this girl. And it was actually the first time I went to treatment. She was the first person I met. It's a very similar interaction that happened between Utah and May. And, I don't know. I developed like a kinship with this girl, and she was around my age and knew I was like a fish out of water. And, I was a painter at the time, and she, you know, came to my room one night and gave me an iPod and said, "Hey, I've unlocked the garage and go in there and whatever." And I went in there, and there was a canvas and there was paint she had brought. And like, you know, it was a really nice gesture because I wasn't sure I was going to stay. And it kept me there. Anyway, that kind of found its way into the script, and it was nice to see that she saw the movie. I hadn't talked to her in a few years and reached out, and you know, we had a nice little catch up about it. But yeah, so her, the therapist, you know, based those, it's there's a lot of people that these characters directly were influenced by. So
what about the house that had all the addicts at it and the woman?
Oh,
like,
yes.
I don't know what to call what would you, it wasn't like a flop. I mean, it was just like addicts hanging out at a house, right?
Yeah,
getting paid.
So, okay. So what's happened in California is that, you know, a lot of these body brokers have now set up these homes where, you know, they're paying clients, they're incentivizing these addicts to go to treatment, obviously not for the right reasons. These kids just want the money. So it's like, hey, go to treatment for 30 days or 60 days. And when you get out, I'll pay you and you can come stay at my house and you can use until your money's up. And then you'll go back in and we'll just do it again. And so a lot of these guys have set up these kind of, yeah, they're kind of flop houses, you know, where they go and they, you know, they can stay as long as they want until they're done using. And then they just go back into treatment.
That's fucking crazy. I didn't even like, I feel like so naive being like, I didn't expect that in California. It's like, I want to put this all on Florida, you know, because like for some reason it makes sense to me that that happens in South Florida because of like the whole opioid epidemic and everything going on. Like it's all been like labeled as like Florida is where all that happens, you know?
Right.
But then it's like, I don't know why, like, it's shocking to me that that's happening in LA and even like still happening, you know, like I know that it is, I guess. I know things have changed, with like all the regulations going on, but like my husband, a friend of his owns, like a rehab and some sober livings. And like, I guess he was like, oh yeah, it's not like it used to be like 5 years ago when they would make like tons of fucking money.
Yeah, I don't think that's true entirely. They just kind of changed the language. So, you know, I think now my understanding is it used to be that you would be paid per client. So now it's like now you can do a direct deal with a treatment center where it's like, oh, you can if you bring me X amount of clients, I'll pay you this amount of money. But it's more of an umbrella thing where you have a deal with a treatment center with bonuses if you bring more. So it's really just like a semantics change now. But at least that's my understanding, you know, so.
Yeah, I took like a intervention training course or whatever, and they were talking about ethics and they're like, is it okay to accept like basketball tickets to get a client into a rehab? And I was like, no, of course not. And some people were like, oh, it's not. You know, it was like a large Zoom of like many people, but I was like, right. How, like, I'm assuming we're all on the same page, everyone. And right. I don't know. It's just crazy to me that people who are sober and like, I mean, I feel like those people aren't really sober too. Like, did you find that those people like identified as sober, but they're people who are like essentially dry and don't go to meetings? Or there's like the level of those scummy people who are in meetings, but like they're pieces of shit.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody who's, who's doing this kind of stuff is truly, working a program and like spiritually fit and all those kind of things that, you know, I guess you attribute to an actual sober person. But yeah, I mean, I feel like most of the people, are just not using. They just, you know, substituted drugs for whatever, like, you know, making money. You know, I mean, but I really empathize with that, you know, and a lot of these people, you know, the perceived villains, and especially in the movie, is because I know myself, and I feel like left to my own devices, you know, I'd take the basketball tickets, you know, I'd be like, yeah, fuck it, whatever, you know, but I understand how, you know, people can, you know, fall, you know, get attracted to greed and, like, you know, all these things. And, you know, so I empathize with those people. I also know, but for me, I have to work that much harder to be, you know, the best version of myself. And I admire the people like you who, you know, right off the bat know it's wrong, you know? So
I didn't always have integrity. For some reason I do with this, but, like, I was a bad person for a very long time. You know, what I feel like is a bad person in terms of, like, the life choices I was making and the life I was living and my lifestyle. And, like, you know, I have a lot of guilt and shame around my past. You know, I was a stripper for 3 years when I was in college and, you know, had a lot of shady stuff going on with that. And, like, you know, it's like, you know, when you get sober, it's like you kind of have this stuff that's, like, implemented into your body. And, like, the more time you get sober and in recovery, like, I look back at that with, like, a stain on myself. And it's like you have to do all this work to be like, you're actually not, like, a bad person now, you know? And, like, all that kind of shit. Like, do you, like, you had talked about, you know, running with, like, a crew and stuff and getting into a lot of trouble, like, in terms of the work that you've done since you've gotten sober, like, what has that been like? And have you had, like, a similar experience with, like, getting rid of maybe, like, old beliefs about yourself and stuff like that?
Yeah, sure. I never was one of those people that, like, hated myself. you know, I think, you know, I've had a God complex or an ego or whatever for, you know, as long as I can remember. So I never had a problem with, like, not liking myself. But I did feel shame and guilt around the things that I had done that hurt other people around me. Mm. And so, you know, I kind of just, you know, I learned, you know, about the whole living amends thing where, like, you know, I need to just, I can't go back and necessarily right all the wrongs from my past, even by, you know, making a formal amends to somebody directly. The best thing I can do is just continue to be honest and, you know, the best version of myself every day. You know, it's, you know, a lot of people, it took years for them to kind of warm back up to me, you know, and see that the change had happened, and rightfully so. You know, so it's been a really interesting experience. But again, I've, you know, I kind of remove myself from, you know, any old, anything that would inspire old habits to come back. You know, I moved across the country up to the woods, with my wife and, quickly just, like, plugged into, you know, the program up there. So really the only people I knew for, like, the first 3 or 4 years of my sobriety were people in recovery, you know, and that was really key for me to separate myself from seeing people that expected me to be a different version of myself or the old version of myself that I was trying to separate from. So, you know, I've been pretty diligent about all that. And my wife is like, she's very sober and works a very, very, rigid program. And so there's not a lot of, leeway for me to be lax, you know?
Yeah,
she's like the sober Gestapo, and she's great. And, so that was key for me also, but, you know, I don't know, you know, making amends, I did go through and do, like, the direct amends process, you know, in the steps. And, that was where I found the most growth for me personally. You know, kind of atoning for those things that I had done. And, you know, most of the time people had forgotten, or, you know, when I told them, they didn't care. And there was a few exceptions to that, but most of the time I had to learn that me apologizing to them wasn't for them, it was for me. Mm-hmm. And, just to, like, hold myself accountable for those things that I'd done. So that was where I saw the most growth in terms of me changing and, you know, really kind of becoming a new person. So,
yeah, I also found that when I made amends, that the things that I thought were the small things were received in like such a bigger way, like right. almost like these people had been waiting for an apology for me to be a bad roommate in college.
Right.
Like so thankful. And I was like, oh, shit, sorry.
Right.
Or like the throwaway ones. That's funny. Yeah, my husband's sober. It's so nice to be married to someone who's also in recovery and looks at their shit. I know that we have a couple of minutes left and I kind of skipped over this, but I was curious about like just like the earlier days and like how you kind of got started. Like, were you always wanting to like be both the writer and director of like the things that you're making? Like, it seems like you pretty much were always the writer and director on all your films.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really have a blueprint or an idea of how to make any of this happen. You know, Jeremy and I always err on the side of doing everything ourselves or as much as we can, because I don't know any other way to get it done. Neither does he. And so when I started, yeah, I mean, I wrote a script that became my first film. And you know, I didn't know how to get it made. I had never worked on a movie set before. So, you know, I casted everybody. You know, we did all the wardrobe shopping. We did all the scouting. We did everything. And you know, I found that to be the best way for me to work and get things done. Because if the minute I rely on somebody that I don't know is the minute I'm fucked, you know, mm-hmm. because they're not going to do things the way I would do them or the pace I would do them. And they're not going to match my care or Jeremy's care or either of our work ethic. So, yeah, it kind of happened by default that way. And, you know, admittedly, I feel like I've learned through my mistakes as a writer and a director. And, you know, I enjoy the process of – I enjoy the whole process of filmmaking a lot. And and so I don't know, I've continued to write and direct and, you know, continued that until now. So
when you said you learn from your mistakes, is there anything that kind of sticks out for you as valuable lessons to repeat to the listener?
Yeah. I mean, it's like a day thing. It's a lot like, it's amazing how much, you know, the filmmaking process reflects the process of sobriety and like the whole, you know, for me at least, you know, mistakes, being accountable, being honest with yourself and others around you. I mean, all these things that eventually, if you don't do in the process of making a film, you're going to pay for them later, or, you know, there's no way to really fix them later. So, you know, for me, it's, the thing I've abided by the most is keeping the people you trust close and keeping your circle small and trusting yourself and trusting people. You know, the minute you kind of let a committee in to make a decision is the minute you're going to regret whatever decision's made, you know, because it's not yours or it's not, you know, of that tight group that's all setting out to do the same thing. You know, with a film, it's really just Jeremy and I. And then everybody else is coming on to help us, but they're not going to living with this thing. And their name's not going to be on it forever. And, you know, if it's bad, they're embarrassed about it for the rest of their life, you know? But when it's good, everybody takes fucking ownership. So I've got to, you know, remember that, you know? So,
yeah, it sounds like you're pretty good about like protecting your vision, because, you know, you saying that you and Jeremy kind of make everything like yourselves. And then I'm sure like once you're adding like a financer or something, like everyone wants to have like a fucking opinion. So like, how do you, I mean, I'm sure what you just said is part of it, but is there any, like, how do you kind of instill that like trust and create that for yourself for you to just do your thing?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the financer and all that, I mean, Jeremy's done a pretty good job of limiting any language that, gives them in at all as to like what they can, you know, say they would like to look like or be. So it kind of starts there in that regard. But then in terms of, you know, with newer actors, it's just, you know, I like collaborating with people. And I think, you know, usually the idea is the third idea where it's like, oh, I have this idea, you have that idea. Well, what comes out discussing both of those is usually a good, like, you know, the best of the ideas. But knowing that, you know, I've made the mistake enough of deferring a decision to somebody else and being in the editing room later and being like, you know, God damn it, I shouldn't have done that. You know, it really boils down. There is a mistake. I want it to be mine. Mm. You know, I don't like, you know, a big thing of my sobriety is not being a victim and not blaming other people for anything, because I am responsible for all things in my life. And if I'm responsible for things that happen, I'm responsible for how I deal with them. So, you know, in terms of the filmmaking process, it's kind of the same. You know, I want to be responsible if there's a mistake. And, you know, it makes it hard to defer, you know, and let other people do their job. But, you know, it's a work in progress theory, I guess. So.
And did you start filmmaking before you were sober, or is that something that came after?
Yeah, no, it started before. I made a short film back in, fuck, I don't even know how long ago it was. And I made a feature film after that, and I was not sober. And since then, starting with Run with the Hunted and every film since, I've been, those were made in C. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I guess that's all I have. Thank you so much, John, for taking the time and coming on. And
thank you.
It was great to talk to you, and I'm so excited for Candyland too.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm really excited. So, yeah, thank you so much for taking the time and for helping us get the word out about this movie.
For sure. Have a good shoot, and yep. Thank you.